For inviting me to talk to you. This is something that's a subject that's very close to my heart, and it's been a focus of my research since I came to Australia 2 years ago to teach at the National Film School. So let me start off with a little story. On the 9th of July last year, On the 9th of July last year, there was a small internet-based entertainment company called JibJab that produced a small 4-minute flash animation called This Land. Now, how many of you have seen This Land? All right. It used the well-known Woody Guthrie folk song to explore the in a very satirical sort of sense, and in a very even-handed sort of sense, the differences between George Bush and John Kerry. And when the website ended, you could click on a link and send a link to a friend. And JibJab started this by putting it up on their website, and they had a mailing list with the people who were interested in their political animations. And so they sent this out just as a link to the few thousand people on that mailing list, trusting that those people were going to find it funny. And believe me, both conservatives and liberals find something to love and hate in that piece. And hoping that those people would then send it to their friends and so on and so forth. And their strategy was very simple. If you post it, they will come. And it worked. And they had hoped that, you know, in their wildest dreams, a million people might come by and see This Land. And by the end of July, so it'd been out 3 weeks, their hopes had been reached, and they were on The Tonight Show talking to Jay Leno about it. And that was only the beginning. Now, by the end of August, when the presidential election starts to hot up in America, that number had risen to 5 million. And in September and October, it was madness, because by the end of October, 50 million people had watched This Land. And by the middle of October, I'd gotten, I don't know how many emails with a link in it, and the last one was from my mother. And you know it's crossed over into the mainstream. And people continue to watch This Land, even though the subject matter's gotten a little stale. 80 million views. 80 million. That's a huge number. You think about it, a blockbuster film in America gets maybe 20 million viewers, and another 20 million internationally. So that's in the range, really, of only the top television broadcasts in the United States, things like the Super Bowl or the Academy Awards. And of course, numbers like that translate into enormous revenues for distributors and for advertisers. Those are the kinds of numbers they salivate over. But somehow, JibJab managed to lose $120,000 on This Land. In early October, the company that hosts its content presented JibJab for a bill because every download of all those 70 million downloads cost them a few pennies. Now, something's really, really wrong here, because anything that's been seen by 70 million people clearly has enormous value. A television producer would know what to do with those kinds of ratings. A film distributor would know what to do with that. And it's not that the Greg and Evan Spiridellis, who are the founders of JibJab, and the writers and the creators and the producers of this amazingly funny short piece of entertainment, are stupid. They aren't stupid. They did everything they could to prepare for success. Well, except for creating a viable financial model. They neglected to find a mechanism to turn eyeballs into revenue. Now, that mistake has been rectified, because if you watch This Land now, you'll see a commercial. I think the last time I watched it, there was a little 30-second Intel commercial that ran right before This Land. But they let 50 or 60 million viewers have it for free, and that was an enormous lost opportunity. So there's a moral to this story. All of us, all of you, are actually unprepared for the economic realities of digital distribution. And it's not because we're lazy or we're stupid. It's because so much has changed so quickly, there isn't any reasonable way to expect you to keep up. You're making things. You're being creatives. Digimart is, in a lot of ways, the first conference in the world to deal with these issues head on. This is a new era of cinema. It's a new era of distribution. What does that mean? And it's a great opportunity where creatives and technologists, and I sit somewhere in between those communities, can actually talk about, in a cohesive sense, in a comprehensive sense, what this means. What does it mean for creativity? What does it mean for marketing? What does it mean for distribution? That's what I've been doing since I got to Sydney 2 years ago. I've been working with film creatives, television creatives, to develop successful economic models for the distribution in an era where all of the rules of distribution have fundamentally changed. It's not easy work, because so much of what we're trying to do right now goes against the traditions of a century of established business practices. It's as if we're trying to build a house on ground that's still moving, and it's very hard to build a house during an earthquake. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. We don't have any alternative. We must try. But we have to learn to be as creative developing revenue models as we are when we're developing our story ideas. So, before I launch into the second part of my presentation, which is where I'm going to explore the evolutions in digital distribution, I want to tell you another story, which is really standing in stark contrast to the story of Jib Jab in this land. And it shows you exactly how weird things have gotten. So, last year, just about the same time that Jib Jab was launching this land, producer Robert Greenwald, based in Los Angeles, was putting the finishing touches on a documentary called Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism. And it's a dissection of how Fox News systematically distorts the news. Now, because he had decided to take on one of the media mega corporations, Greenwald found that he couldn't really get any press in any other mainstream media because, as a closed oligarchy, the media corporations are loath to pick on each other because they know that will just end up in a free-for-all. So how does he promote his film? Well, interestingly, Greenwald had received support for the film to make the film from two American political action committees, MoveOn.org and the Center for American Progress. And so Greenwald worked with MoveOn.org, got their mailing list, and said, okay, this is what we're going to do. MoveOn, I want you to coordinate 3,000 viewing parties across the United States. People who will sponsor to have a viewing party in their home will get a free DVD of the film, but they must promise to show the film to at least 10 people. And MoveOn, through their mailing list and through their website, coordinated who would go to which living room. And so on a Sunday evening, 7 p.m., they watch the movie, and then there's a teleconference. You can dial in and you can ask questions to Robert Greenwald. And so all the people in the various living rooms did that. So probably around 30,000 people got to see the film that night. The next morning, the DVD went for sale on Amazon. 48 hours later, it was number one. 1 month later, it had sold 150,000 copies. Now, one of the reasons it did so well is because Greenwald priced Outfoxed at $9.95. It was very inexpensive. It was almost an impulse buy. If you wanted to see the film, it was very easy to go on Amazon, grab it, take it home. So he only made about $1.5 million of revenue, gross, on that. But the film only cost $300,000 to make, so he clearly made a profit. And the interesting thing is, from the evidence of that kind of success, Greenwald was immediately offered a theatrical distribution deal. So it got into cinemas in America, in Canada, in the UK, and in Australia. And that proves that distribution isn't just something that goes on between a filmmaker and a distributor. You can create an entirely new model. You can roll one out of the whole cloth. If the content's good, if you manage to find your market, it's going to work. Now, next month, Greenwald's next film is coming out. It's about Walmart. But he doesn't have to worry about the retailer's strength in the marketplace. He's going around it. He's created a new distribution venue. And new distribution vehicles are about to become ridiculously common. One of the exciting things about being at Digimart today is I think I've learned 10 completely different, completely reasonable distribution models that have nothing to do with the tried and true models that we all perhaps walked in here this morning thinking were the way things are going to be done. And it may very well be that each of the projects you're involved in from here on in will require the development of its own unique distribution strategy. That, in fact, as individual as a film is, the distribution strategy needs to be that individual. This is an era of radical invention. And it's an era where everything that looked ridiculous about film distribution a few years ago now seems perfectly reasonable. All right. Now, I've been hearing all morning and into the afternoon that digital cinema isn't a technology. That's an interesting point of view. It's wrong. All right. Film is quintessentially a technologically based medium. It has been since 1895. And film and technology walk in lockstep. If you don't believe me, ask Danielle. All right. What I want to do in this second part of the talk is I want to talk to you about the technology of digital distribution, because I want you to understand why what's going on in technology is so fundamentally important to what you're doing. Because before we can consider the economic models for the distribution of cinema, or radio, or books, or TV or whatever have you, we have to look at the overall direction of the change of the technology. And that's away from rigid and well-established systems of distribution into anarchic, fickle, and undeniably piratical swarms of possibilities. We also have to get clear on our terms. We use the words digital distribution, and that could mean anything from a punched card to a satellite. In the context of what I want to discuss, I'm going to use the term networked digital distribution. That is using the pervasive wired, cellular, and orbital networks as the foundation for the distribution of creative productions. In that model, no atoms are ever moved from place to place, only zeros and ones. So, in the beginning, 1995, there were companies like Apple and Real Networks, which is at the time called Progressive Networks, and they developed technologies that allowed you to stream media, either audio alone or audio visual, it didn't really matter, and you could stream it from a single server to any number of audience members. And it worked remarkably well given the crude state of the internet back in 1995. You could click on the mouse a few times and you might be listening to a radio station that was in another city or another part of the world. You might be watching a nice trailer for a soon-to-be-released movie. That technology today is now known as netcasting. And it's a fair bet that everyone in this audience has experienced some form of netcast at some time or another. But netcasting has one inherent flaw. It doesn't scale. It's easy enough for you, as a small company, to provide a stream for 10 people, maybe even 100 people. But each time you add an audience member, it requires more bandwidth, it requires more computer power, and it requires more money. Now that's the lesson of JibJab. So supplying a stream for a million people is out of the realm of possibility for any except for the largest organizations. This is very different than broadcasting. In broadcasting, your costs are fixed over a given geographical territory. You put up a transmitting tower, and you can reach everyone within range of that tower for the same price, whether you have one viewer or 10 million. So, with netcasting, popularity is a bad thing. And that's kept netcasting confined to the margins of distribution since it was conceived of. Now we jump forward 4 years to 1999. And we get to the first evolution of digital distribution beyond netcasting. It goes by several names, including peer-to-peer networking or file sharing, or as I prefer to call it, super distribution. And the archetypal example of that is Napster. When Napster first had its debut, this is before it was taken down and reborn again as sort of a doppelganger, it presented itself as little more than a centralized database. That database could be searched for the files that were available on the computers of all the users who were logged into the database. So I could actually look at the contents of the disk drives of everyone that was on Napster. Napster didn't store the files. All Napster did was says, oh, Joe's got a file over here, Tim's got a file over here, Joe and Tim talk to each other. Joe wants Tim's file, then I'll just allow Joe to find out what Tim's machine is, and then Joe can go and grab that file directly, and then it will download to Joe's hard disk. That's a peer-to-peer connection, and it's the hallmark of super distribution. A file that's anywhere on the network is available to everyone on the network, and the centralized server just keeps information about where the files are found. Now, of course, this is the point in the conversation where the media creatives, who make their money off of copyright, break out into a cold sweat. Napster was clearly, at that time, responsible for the largest act of copyright violation in history. And they paid a price for that, the ultimate price. But the success of file sharing, despite the death of Napster, and despite the repeated and continual attempts of major commercial and political organizations to stamp it out, shows that a powerful idea cannot be wished out of existence. It's like the atomic bomb, you cannot unbuild it. Copyright violations aside, before it was shut down, Napster gave you the whole world of music. It was really an amazing thing. It wasn't just popular hits. It was the obscure and the archaic and the bizarre. I had a friend who was gathering up Tin Pan Alley songs from the 1930s, and another who was collecting 50s European electronic music. It's a big world, and the tastes in that world are more than Celine Dion to Green Day. And that was available on Napster for a brief shining moment. Now, notwithstanding the legal issues that are involved, peer-to-peer networks still have a basic flaw. When you're downloading something, when Joe is downloading from Tim, you're depending on the good graces of the two machines that are involved in the transaction. If Tim suddenly goes away, or if his machine crashes, or if there's a power outage, or whatever it is, you've got to find another source. And if there are only a very few sources for files, that's a very hard thing to do. In other words, super distribution is not reliable. And Mark Cuban talked about that this morning. Now, it can scale far beyond netcasting, but the audience experience for it can be much more frustrating. We come to the third era. In 2002, following the collapse of Napster and the dot-com era in general, a new technology surfaced, which would once again fundamentally change the landscape of digital distribution. That technology is known as BitTorrent, and although most of you have heard the term before, I want to explain to you in very concrete terms how BitTorrent works. Let's say for a moment that I have made a movie, and I've made a couple of movies, and I want to share this movie with each one of you. Now, this is a digital film, and because it's a digital film, and because I have an internet connection and I have a computer, I can make infinite copies of this digital film, and I can give it to you. But my ability to do so is limited by two factors. One is how fast my computer is to be able to churn out these copies. And the second, and more important factor, is how fast am I connected to the internet? If we think about netcasting, if every one of you, and a million of you besides, wanted a copy of the film, and I was the only place where you could get that film, you would be standing in a queue, one after another, as I slowly served up copy one, copy two, copy three, copy four. Now, how could I do it a different way? What I'm going to do is I'm going to take my film is broken down into frames, I'm going to take a copy of frame one, I'm going to give it to Corey, and copy of frame two and give it to Sheila, and a copy of frame three and give it to Danielle, and so on and so on and so on, so that each one of you has a copy of my film. And it's a short film. There's only 100 frames in it, so it's cover the audience 4 seconds. Now, I'm going to let you all know that you all have frames of my film. And now I'm going to let you talk to each other. And all of you are going to have a conversation with each other. And Corey's going to say, I have frame one. I really need frames 2 through 99. Who's got them? Oh, I've got them. Okay. All of a sudden, Corey has frame one and frame 43. And he says, oh, I've got frame one and frame 43. And someone says to him, I need frames one and frames 43. But this is going on with all of you simultaneously. And so what happens is very, very, very quickly, everyone in this room has a complete copy of my entire film. That's the geek part of the lecture. That's called a swarm, because what's happening is all I'm doing is providing one copy of the film, not to one person, but just generally across the entire room. And then I'm letting the fact that all of you are also on the internet with me take care of the business of making copies of that film. It's a virtuous cycle, too, because if another person came into the room and asked for a copy of the film, who would he be able to ask for the copy? He'd be able to ask everyone in the room for a copy. And then if another person comes in and another person comes in, and the funny thing about BitTorrent is that the more people who are asking for copies, the easier it is for every successive person to get a copy. It's called a virtuous cycle. Now this technology in its whole is known as hyperdistribution. It's more efficient than netcasting because I could distribute my entire film over a very, very slow network link. I could do it over a dial-up link because all I have to do is make sure that one copy gets out there. And after that, everything takes care of itself. It's more efficient than super distribution because so many of you have copies of the film or parts of the copies or overlapping copies that if one of you goes away, the others will fill it in. So it's what they call resilient. It's very hard for this transaction to go badly. Mark Cuban was talking about a bad user experience using BitTorrent. That's bullshit. All right? BitTorrent, in fact, has the highest quality user experience that you can expect because it is by far the highest quality form of network transfer of information ever invented, not just for file sharing, but for anything in general. Now, even though it's only 3 years old, 45% of all network traffic right now, minimally, as near as they can tell, is BitTorrent traffic. It's efficient, it's fast, and it's reliable. And that's a trilogy that trumps any other possible mechanism for distribution. And although it was not designed to enable copyright violations, and in fact it's really bad at it because BitTorrent exposes all of this information about what computer you're on and where you are in the world, about 90% of everything being traded on BitTorrent is in violation of copyright. Now that said, there are numerous legitimate uses for BitTorrent, and we'll come to those. But I don't want you to overlook the forest for the trees, because BitTorrent is here to stay, and BitTorrent allows anyone, anywhere, to send anything to everybody. That's why the going has gotten so weird. Okay, I've done my very best to present an accurate picture of the present. I gave you a little technology background because I feel you need to understand the ground that we're standing on right now. Even though it's moving, it's got this very odd foundation that's very different. It hasn't appeared before. But I've only told part of the story. There's a much broader story, and it is invariably overlooked by media creatives because it is so damn scary. There is, as it were, a gigantic elephant in the middle of the living room of the very comfortable media industries that we're all engaged in, and it's going to change everything. It all hinges on one very important distinction, the difference between the professional class of media creatives and the amateur. Now, were I to ask you about the difference between a professional and an amateur, you would most likely tell me that a professional is paid for their work and an amateur does it out of love. But underneath that is another bedrock assumption about the systems of commerce which undergird the creative industries. Professionals are paid for the work because there are established systems of distribution which allow for that work to be metered and monitored and paid for. Your film or television professional only if you can get your works into distribution. Otherwise, you're just an amateur wannabe. Distribution is the gatekeeper. We just heard that on this panel, which separates the able from the willing, or at least it was. Now, a handful of years ago, the only way to watch a motion picture was to go to the theater or to rent a VHS or a DVD. That is now no longer the case. It is easier to get a film or a television show using BitTorrent than it is to go to the theater or to the video store. And in general, there's a far greater selection. Now, most of the content on BitTorrent consists of materials in violation of copyright. But BitTorrent, interestingly, has turned the entire internet into a sort of giant TiVo. Every program broadcast on TV within the last couple of weeks on any major network around the world is available on BitTorrent. So you don't have to record it, you can just grab it off the torrent. Every DVD released within the last few weeks or months. That's a fundamental challenge to the media mega corporations because they earn the largest share of their revenue these days from DVD sales and from television rights to their productions. BitTorrent attacks the root of their revenues. So they attack BitTorrent, they try to shut down the trackers, they try to shut down the torrent sites which host files, and they've been forcing the BitTorrent network to adapt because every time they attack, BitTorrent evolves and it becomes ever more invisible, ever more difficult to track, and ever more pervasive. BitTorrent is not going away and file sharing is not going away. It's what the audience wants. In order to make it go away, you would have to change audience behavior. Good luck with that. Now, the industry sees this wholesale violation of copyright as their biggest threat. They're wrong. They too are ignoring the elephant in the living room. BitTorrent is not about the theft of copyright. If you look at it that way, you're missing the point. BitTorrent is a way for anyone, anywhere, to distribute anything to everyone. We've never had that before because of the aforementioned inefficiencies in netcasting and in super distribution. BitTorrent amends those errors. It gives us a system that's easy enough for anyone to use and reliable enough for everyone to trust. That means that the gatekeepers of distribution have effectively ceased to exist. If you want to get your film out to 1 million people or even 1 billion people, you now have the means and it won't cost you anything to do this. Now, distribution has functioned as the economic barrier which separates professional from amateur. But distribution has now become ubiquitous and inexpensive. So what separates the professional from the amateur? The professional has the advantage of distribution. Well, they lost the advantage of distribution. Now professional and amateur both have equal access to the audience. And This is the point where media professionals invariably make some sort of bitchy comment about quality, that the audience prefers the quality of a professional production to the quality of an amateur production. And then generally someone mutters something about community access cable television to drive the point home. And this argument, which seems very reasonable in its face, is in fact both insulting to the amateur creative and arrogant in its misunderstanding of the audience. In the age of mass media, mass audiences were best served by professional productions. But the age of mass media ended when the day of hyper-distribution began. Mass media need an oligarchy of distribution channels in order to maintain their hegemony over the audience. That hegemony has been overrun by the barbarian hordes of BitTorrent. The future is not about audiences in the millions or billions, though those will continue to exist according to power law distributions, but it's about audiences in the hundreds or thousands, and it is in this arena that the amateur arises to its full stature. The amateur creates a work because of love for the material. It may not be as polished as the work of a professional, but what it will convey, if it is at all successful, is relevance. In a world where the number of media choices is rapidly approaching infinity, and that is the very first byproduct of the age of hyper-distribution, relevance trumps production values every time. Consider the average member of the 21st century audience. Embedded in a world that is utterly saturated with media, an individual who is bombarded with choices about how to spend their ever more valuable coin, their attention, do they in that situation opt for a mainstream production with high production values, or do they opt for a more intimate piece which speaks more directly to them? More and more, we will see the audience opt for relevance, particularly as the choice grows infinitely broad. People will not retreat into decision paralysis, as some people suggest. Instead, they will opt for individualized, personalized choice. We can already see this in the rapidly multiplying number of magazines that are being published, in the, I don't know, was it 12 blogs a second that are being added to the internet, in the iPod playlists that are being passed around. As media choice grows, taste grows radically more individual. So as the audience takes control of distribution, because that's really what's happening, they assume control over their media diet. And we can already see this happening in form of ad hoc links that get passed around by email. I get tens of these links per day, pointing me at some sort of short film or flash animation or audio track or web page. These are things that my friends forwarded on to me because they liked it, and they think, because they know me, that I'll like it too. And before I sat down to write this piece, I clicked on a link and found, and I'm not kidding, a ukulele version of George Harrison's While My Guitar Gently Weeps. That sounds like a joke, but the kid playing it is a pro, and it's actually really good. It's as good as anything I've heard on the radio or MTV lately, and it's not nearly so overproduced. It has a nice authenticity that's really interesting. And it was 3 minutes of my life that I didn't immediately want back. And of course, what did I do? I took the link and I forwarded it on to a couple of my friends who I thought would really enjoy it, and so on and so on and so on. And that's what happened to Jib Jab. And that's the future for media distribution. It's these amateurs creating things and sharing with each other and letting these networks connect and affiliate and produce their own networks of distribution, which are temporary, which are fleeting, but which are, on the whole, larger, more pervasive, more singular than any centralized network of distribution. And all of this is about to become very formal. We have websites like Delicious, which you should take a look at if you haven't. There's a new browser called Flock, which is about to come out, which is designed to make all of this sharing, this social sharing of media, easier and easier and easier. Right now, it's something that's a little bit hard to do. As it gets easier and easier, well, you're going to see everyone do it. You're going to see my mom doing it. And the interesting thing about that is that in 2005, no one is dependent on marketing anymore to tell them what to watch or what to listen to. They can search for themselves or they can heed their friends' recommendations. So it's a lovely future and it's a great time to be an amateur. But here's the thing. I've more or less demolished the existing economic basis of professional creative productions. Not because of rampant piracy, which is what everyone thinks is going to destroy it. That's a canard. But because the audience itself is exhibiting a swarming behavior. which makes it both the creator and the consumer of media productions. There is no need for an externally constituted entity which serves up productions for a hungry audience. The audience is learning to feed itself. So, while digital distribution offers an enormous opportunity to distribute creative works internationally and instantaneously, it comes at a high price. The recordings that you, the same techniques that you use to distribute your productions are available to everyone. Now, this is not without precedent. When the recording industry embraced the CD back in 1982, they saw it as a new distribution medium, superior qualities to vinyl. But of course, it was a digital medium, so it allowed people to make fidelity, perfect fidelity copies of their media. And that's produced the current and ongoing slow motion collapse of the music industry. And you can't have it both ways. When you move away from atoms, when you move away from vinyl into the world of bits, there are certain qualities that you get that you want, and there are certain qualities you get that you don't want. You have to take them both. You can't have one and not the other. So either you stick to film stock and slowly go the way of the dinosaurs with respect to theatrical distribution. And theatrical distribution is going to get me into a lot of trouble. It's going to undergo the same slow speed collapse that we've seen in the music industry. So if you hook your wagon to that star, you're not going to be around. So in the end, you don't have any choice at all. Now, just because people are giving their work away freely does not mean that people will not pay for work. There is such a thing as intrinsic value, and there is such a desire that audiences want to reward artists for their work, if only because they want to see more work. No one wants to see an artist starve. There is a value relationship between the artist and the audience, but it is no longer mediated by distribution. That's the key. The true difference between an amateur and a professional is that a professional can get paid for their work. Now, what coin that payment comes in, that's the open question right now. And that's the one for which there is no one right answer. So, let me close with a story that brings all of these elements together. In the summer of 2003, a few folks playing the video game Halo, which runs on the Xbox, realized that they could, with a few simple and undocumented commands of their joysticks, make their on-screen characters tilt their heads ever so slightly, as if they were engaged in conversation. Now, this was Mike Burns, Jeff Ramsey, and Matt Hullum. They got together and realized that they could simply tape the output of their video game, slap a soundtrack onto it, and create, for no money at all, an animated 3D cartoon. And they have a strong sense of the absurd, really strong writing skills, and they had a studio in the box, courtesy of Halo and their Xbox. They were able to create a cartoon series called Red vs. Blue. Now, how many of you have seen Red vs. Blue? I'm gonna have to run an episode after this because that's not enough of you. They did this with no money, with the equipment that they had on hand, and they did it in their spare time. They started writing and producing a series of 19 episodes. They're between 3 and 7 minutes in length. And they didn't have a lot of bandwidth, so they put them up on their server, but really what they did was they decided someone must have talked them into using this crazy new technology called BitTorrent, and they put the episodes up on the BitTorrent. They gave it away. And it's a good thing that they did, because within a few months, 1 million people were watching Red vs. Blue episodes. It's really interesting. You'll see the writing is very sharp and funny, and the animation, it's modern video game quality animation, so it's not bad. But the storytelling is what it's all about. Now, they didn't set out to make money from Red vs. Blue. In amateur style, they decided they were going to create for the love of the work. But they have made money. God bless George Lucas. He's figured out how to make money off of things. Of course, he makes money off the theatrical release too, but he figured out the swag agenda. And so you can get DVDs, CDs, hats, jackets, messenger bags, mouse pads, t-shirts, blah, blah, blah. Now, they don't own the copyright to Halo. You know who does? Microsoft. Halo is a Microsoft game. And there was always this sneaking sensation that someday the hammer was going to come down and Microsoft was going to call and ask for their game back. Well, they got the call from Microsoft, and Microsoft asked them to produce an episode of Red vs. Blue to promote the upcoming Windows Developers Conference, and paid them. Somehow, to their credit, Microsoft figured out that the popularity of Red versus Blue did not dilute the popularity of their video game franchise. And in fact, there are features in version 2, Halo 2, which were specifically put in there to make it easier for the folks at Red versus Blue to make their games. So the success of Red versus Blue, and this is the first probably unqualified success of the age of hyperdistribution, leads to a curious sort of logic, and it's something I want you to take away. The more something is shared, the more valuable it becomes. It strikes against the common sense of the marketplace, but the marketplace isn't like anything we've known before, and different economics apply. As I stated in the title, the going's gotten weird, and when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. Thank you.